room. Thank you all for coming on this somewhat damp and chilly night. I'm going to be talking about what you just heard. No, that hasn't been changed. Here is an example of a splash. A drop of milk has fallen into a saucer of milk. That produced a splash, this crown-shaped object. I'll show you later on how that object is formed and what happens to it. This is a photograph by a man by the name of Edgerton. Edgerton worked in the period around the Second World War and was a great lover of photographs. I'm going to show you a whole bunch of his photographs here. He was the inventor of strobe photography, and this is a rather fast piece of photograph for us today. I'll start out by reading the abstract of my talk and then try to ad lib. The major reason for reading it is that I have a peculiar southern accent, and if I read this to you, you'll probably glom on to my accent. The fundamental laws of physics are very simple. They can be written on the top half of an ordinary piece of paper. The world around us is very complex. Whole libraries hardly serve to describe it. Indeed, any living organism exhibits a degree of complexity quite beyond the capacity of our libraries. This complexity has led some thinkers to suggest that living things are not the outcome of physical law, but instead the creation of a superintelligent designer. We'll come back to this issue of intelligent design later on in the talk. In this talk, we mostly examine the development of complexity in fluid flow. Examples include splashing water, necking of fluids, swirls in heated gases, and jets thrown up from beds of sand. We watch complexity develop in front of our eyes. Mostly we're able to understand and explain what we're seeing. We, that is, we scientists and mathematicians who work on such things, do our work by following the succession of very specific situations. In looking at these very specific problems, we soon get to broader issues, predictability and chaos, mechanisms for generation of complexity and simple laws, and finally the question of whether there is a natural tendency towards the formation of complex machines in the universe. This is a question which, in the form of deciding about schools' curriculum, has vexed the U.S. political scene, vexed the political scene less here in Canada, I'm told. But let me start up. I will tell you a little bit about myself. It's somewhat relevant from the point of view I bring to this talk. I'm a physicist and a mathematician. I've worked on lots and lots of different things. In the 50 years or so, I've been a mathematical scientist, but I've mostly worked recently on problems related to our familiar world, the fluids, the air, the oceans, the lakes around us. That work I do includes clouds and waves, splashes and storms, sonic booms and the quiet ripples on ponds. I say it includes that, but only by extension. I study, as most scientists study, highly oversimplified situations, trying to get at the root of what is happening. My own work involves mostly working things out in mathematical descriptions using pencil and paper and perhaps a computer. I work closely with experimentalists, and you'll see some of their pictures. And we all work together on what happens in fluids. There are three purposes to such work. First purpose is to demonstrate that these familiar phenomena can be understood and predicted, and hence are not at all mysterious. You understand that this talk is sort of moving in the direction of an argument between some people and other people about what should be presented in the schools And it comes down to this argument about how much we should be mystified by what we see around us, how much it is a product of the world we cannot see, how much it is a product of the physical laws that we do see. The next purpose of the work we do on fluids is to train students to use their own minds to understand and predict the areas in which they work and observe. Of course, for the purposes of giving a talk like this, you and I are all students, and we are all trying to understand and do these things. And the third purpose is to develop tools and concepts which can be used in practical work with fluids. The practical work which we must all do together, you must do in the Canadian context and I in the U.S. context, is as citizens contribute to the idea of what should go into a school's curriculum. And this is something that we should, as citizens and as people who are knowledgeable, want to take part in and contribute to. This is a list of references for the talk. This in part based on work that I did with Nigel Goldenfeld and published in Science. The intelligent design point of view is presented by Michael Beeton in his book Darwin's Black Box and William Dembski in his book No Free Lunch. It goes back to the thought of William Paley in 1802, the book title is Natural Theology. There's a criticism, I think a act of intelligent criticism in H. Allen Orr's article entitled Devolution in the New Yorker. The rest of this is scientific stuff about the scientific stuff that I'll tell you about, but I'll have to not leave it up and go on to the next thing. Oh, before I go on to the next thing, I should say something more about myself. I've had the pleasure and honor of being elected to being vice president of the American Physical Society. I'm not quite sure the geographical entity that America refers to. I noticed that there's a Canadian Association of Physics, which has much the same purposes as the American Physical Society, and that many people belong to both organizations. I mention that this in the context of the talk because I'm going to, as a member of that organization and as a representative of that organization, I'm going to have to offer advice to anyone who will listen. That's the role of a public figure. Advice to anyone who will listen about such subjects as intelligent design. And I want to make my thoughts more mature and listen to criticisms from intelligent audiences early on in the process so that I make myself less of a fool than I would otherwise. Okay, but back to science and that kind of thing. To start and organize any scientific work, it's often useful to think about the great questions that nature poses for us and how they might be answered. One such question is, why is the world so complicated? To back up and look at that question in the face, I should notice in contrast that one of the great concepts of my physics profession is the simplicity of the laws of physics. The equations for electricity and magnetism, or the ones for classical or quantum mechanics, can each be expressed in a few lines. Those lines are written in the form of partial differential equations, language which would be arcane to some of you and highly understandable to others. These partial differential equations give precise predictions of the time rates of change of various things like the velocity of a fluid in terms of the rates of change in space of, say, the velocity of a fluid. Physicists have a worldview which has a very simple foundation, and I state it here. Most physicists, I think, would agree with the statement. The world is lawful, and the same basic laws hold everywhere and always. New domains of nature may require new laws, but all the different laws are consistent with one another. Everything is simple, neat, and expressible in terms of what for us is everyday mathematics, ordinary or partial differential equations. Everything is simple and neat, except, of course, the world. So before we say we understand something, we better look at it. And we better look at the different kinds of complexity that arise in nature. Here is something which is not complex, but indeed is what you might see in a bad physics course. Now, nobody here has ever taken a bad physics course, so I'll have to tell you about the contents of a bad physics course. In the bad physics course, the world is the same damn thing over and over again, repeated without variation and change. Just these simple laws and their simple outcomes, and the job is to turn the crank that gives the outcome from the law. Now, it ain't necessarily so. Here is an example chosen almost at random from the world. It is something magnified 200 times and put up for your observation. It is clearly not simple in that it has different objects, each of them slightly different from one another, each of them in a different scale of magnification, each of them in some interesting way alike and in some other interesting way different. What is it? Well, it's a surface of a cake of soap magnified some 200 times, and those things you see represent layers which can slide on top of one another and make the soap slippery. On a somewhat different scale, here is an aerial photograph of an estuary with a river emptying out into a bay and dumping mud and silt into the bay. Again, the same basic thing with variations repeated again and again, forming a complex and interesting pattern. Yet another one. This one is simpler than the others. A fluid is flowing from in this direction, in the direction I'm walking. Right here, there is a round thing deflecting the fluid. As the fluid gets deflected, it forms swirls downstream. You can see the swirls because the fluid which is moving in has some smoke in it. And the swirls are repeated with slight variations again and again and again as you go downstream. Words. Complexity, that word, means that we have structure with variations. Chaos means that there are many variations and it's hard to predict which one will come out in a given place and time. A complex world is interesting. In a chaotic world, we don't know what's coming next. Our world, of course, is both complex and chaotic. But let's continue to look and use our eyes and see what we can see about it. I told you before about a splash. And the picture that Harold Egerton took of that splash. Mr. Egerton had a great difficulty taking a picture of the splash. It always seemed to come out messy. Here's a late stage in the splash that you saw before, a splash like the one you saw before. And as you can see, the different pieces do different things. Well, let me go through the dynamics of it. A drop of milk forms falls into the surface of a container full of milk. It makes a crater, the crater grows up and becomes a sort of crown. The crown gets points on it, the way a crown of a king or queen has points on the end. Notice that these points are not all like one another. As hard as Harold Edgerton worked, just that hard, he could not make the He could not make this thing into a symmetrical object. He could not achieve the simplicity and symmetry that he wanted. Why not? Well, there were small breaths of air at the beginning, going this way and that way. The natural dynamics of this process enhanced the effect, magnified the effect of these small breaths of air, until when you got to this stage, some of the pieces of the crown, when you got to this stage, some of the pieces of the crown had come apart and others remained together. Some pieces looked like this, which is just a bump up there, and other pieces looked like that, which is a drop coming off the end. And at the end, the various things happen at different times. This is truly a complex phenomenon. And that complex phenomenon is, it's the wrong word, but it's the word I found, crowned by an unexpected event. That unexpected event is that a drop of fluid comes up from the center, shoots up in the air, and perhaps unexpectedly hits the investigator in the eye. Now, the world is full of complex objects. Here are two that fell down before, and I didn't get in at the right time in the talk, but there are two important and interesting complex objects. This is a magnetic storm on the planet Jupiter. The color is due to NASA, so we can't claim nature has produced the coloring. But the storm, with different kinds of activity here and here and there, the swirls and the relatively simple straight motion, the variations seem to be a natural part of nature, something that nature has done. If I'm talking about religion, I shouldn't allow myself to say that nature has done it for herself, but nonetheless, it's what comes naturally to mind. This is what nature has done for herself. This complexity. Now, none of that complexity compares with the complexity of natural life. This guy, if I had him, this is magnified 200 times also, like the cake of soap. And this guy is a living thing, a mosquito, formed of various parts, each part with many sort of repeated things. It's based on a cellular structure in which each cell contains the same DNA. Each cell contains the same basic material as every other cell and consists of parts. Each part specialized to perform a function. That function, if we are anthropomorphic, that function is to bedevil us. And if we are Darwinian, the function is to reproduce and have more other little guys like this to bedevil us. But whatever you say, this is a level of complexity with specialized parts and interrelated functioning quite beyond what I've shown in the other pictures. I'm going to start again. I'm going to go look at another example. I've been giving this talk for many years, but intelligent design is a relative newcomer to the talk, and so I the flow of the jokes and so forth doesn't go quite as naturally because of the intelligent design. In the United States, a political and intellectual discussion is going on concerning a point of view called intelligent design. Its proponents argue that biological systems, like our mosquito, are too complex to have been the product of a natural evolution, Darwinian or otherwise, but instead are the results of a fashioning by some super-intelligent creator, or creator with capital letters. One expression of the idea, particularly clear and beautiful, came from William Paley, who lived up until the beginning of the 19th century. He argued that the world contains things like you and me, too complex to have arisen in any natural fashion. He furthermore argued that if you could use your eyes, you could tell the difference between something that got fashioned by nature and something which had been created by some intelligent creator. He suggested the example of what you would do, what you would think of if you found a functioning pocket watch on the beach. You would think that some person had fashioned this complex machine. In our own day, there are two important proponents of the scientific point of view related to that of William Paley. One proponent, Michael Behe, is a biochemist who cites the amazing complexity of biological things, particularly looking down to the level of a single cell. Another is my ex-student, a philosopher and mathematician, Bill Dembski, who argues that there are theorems which show that you cannot construct anything really complex starting from only simple things. I sympathize with Behe's wonder in the observed world. I'll talk more about Dembski anon. For now, let's see how complex things happen. So now I'm going to go through two examples. One example involves fluid heated from below. Nothing more complicated than that. And at the end, I will show you how that results in something which looks complicated and looks rich. Not as rich as the mosquito, but rich. The basic thing we deal with is a pot of fluid, like water, heated from below and cooled from above. The heated fluid, if it is above 4 degrees centigrade, the heated fluid has a lower density than the cooler fluid, and that makes the heated fluid, to express another religious point of view now, that of Aristotle, want to rise. This rising in the form, if you don't heat it much, that rising will not occur. At a certain heating level, you start to get a rising, and that produces a flow of hot fluid up and cooler fluid down, represented by the red arrow and the blue arrow. If the rate of heating is increased, so there's more of a temperature difference between bottom and top, then the simple motion, simple sort of circular motion I showed you, starts to get more complicated. It gets chaotic. Different pieces start wiggling and shaking, and the different pieces wiggle and shake independently of one another, and we say that the system has gone chaotic, and we draw a couple of pictures of chaotic stuff, and then we say if the heating gets really high, so it gets really chaotic, the thing has gone turbulent, and here is a picture of that turbulent state of motion. You can see that something is coming down on the outside, something is going up on the other side, that there's a relatively quiescent region in the middle, but also that there's some complexity going on. Let's see how we would look at that. Well, one way to look at that, as we are mathematicians, is to express it in terms of equations. These equations that I write down here are called the Boussinesq equations. They are based on the Navier-Stokes equations, room for a whole bunch of nationalisms, and they have been expressed in various ways. The equations are written down here. I will go through the first one, telling you what it says, I will also tell you it's not tremendously informative for this purpose. It talks about the time derivative of the velocity of the fluid called u. It says that time derivative is produced because the velocity of the fluid carries other fluid into the region we are looking at, and that's this term. It's also produced because there is a gradient of pressure in the fluid. Well, you know all about gradients of pressure from looking at hurricanes and their description on the TV. Gradients of pressure are what drive hurricanes. Then there is a viscous flow, a sort of friction within the fluid that tends to slow it down. And then there's a term proportional to the temperature of the fluid and the acceleration of gravity. That's a force on the fluid produced because some portions of the fluid are lighter and some portions of the fluid are heavier, less dense and more dense, and that term represents that. That's what the equation represents to the trained mathematician or physicist, more or less. And there are similar descriptions of the other two equations in the set. Altogether, the equations are called the Boussinesq equations. Hardly anyone can tell by looking at the equations what they might imply for fluids in motion. They are enigmatic. Either computer studies or experiments are required to get one started. However, it is certainly true that the equations contain all the information we need to understand the fluids. We are just too weak at interpreting that. I put up the picture once more of the fluid motion that we're trying to understand, and now put up another picture which represents the fluid motion. In this picture, you can see a funny thing hanging down here. That funny thing is a thermometer measuring the temperature right there. There's another thermometer right about there. Here is the thermometer reading as a function of time, as it depends on time. This is time in seconds, 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, etc. This is the thermometer on the top. This is the fever chart of the fluid. This is the fever chart of the measured by the thermometer on the bottom. I can't make anything out of it. I've tried professionally. I put it down there. Okay, it's nice to look at, so you ought to try. Okay, I want something that I can understand, hold in my hands, and convey to you. Well, there is stuff here that I can hold in my hands and convey to you. There is an object that appears and reappears in pictures of heated fluid. This object is called a plume. Let me explain about a plume. Some fluid, maybe like me, is heated up. That heated fluid is sitting in a cooler fluid around it. Because of that, gravity pulls down harder on the fluid around it, and this fluid, following Aristotle, wants to go up. Or at least there's a force on the fluid following Newton, which pushes it upward. Let's follow Newton, there's a force pushing it upward, and it starts to rise. Then it must displace the fluid above it. There's fluid above it, and must displace the fluid above it. It pushes on the fluid above it, again following Newton, going one Newton's second law action equals reaction. The hot fluid, push up, the cold fluid above me pushes back, an impasse is reached, but that's solved by having the cold fluid above move outward, beginning to form the cap of a mushroom. That mushroom cap gets better and better form. It's pushing outward like that. It pushes that way, and it's curled underneath until you get a whole curlicue structure out there. You will see some elements of this in the next pictures I'm going to show you. I'm going to show you pictures of heat and fluid. First, let's find the plume in this set of pictures. We'll find the plumes. Well, there are plumes all over. There are hot plumes coming up there, 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 and the plumes bunch up there, but you can see this plume very clearly. There's its head, and its neck sticks all the way down there. If I were coordinated properly, I'd follow it down. Yes, there you go. There are then also cold plumes, plumes with cold heads and cold feet moving down on the other side. You can see them here. Plumes can be seen in many different places in nature. This is just organizational stuff. Here is a picture of plumes. Hot fluid is created by, fluid is heated by this candle. The candle produces rising fluid in the form of plumes like this one, or this one here, or better yet, this one here. Now, there's some stuff which is irrelevant in the picture. This bullet has no purpose in the picture except to show you that Edgerton was a cowboy. He had fast film, and he wanted to tell you about it. So this fast film took the picture of the bullet and showed what is technically called a shockwave there, and Edgerton had a great time with this. Ladies and gentlemen, ignore the bullet in the middle of the picture. You should concentrate your attention on the plume. Why should you concentrate your attention on the plume? Well, the plume is a wonderful object which we can find in laboratory studies. Here's a laboratory study that shows a beautiful plume constructed by just heating in the lab in an environment which is carefully controlled. Not all plumes appear in carefully controlled environments. Here is a plume produced. I have the whole picture here. The writing on it, yes, the writing is Cyrillic, so we might guess that the plume was produced somewhat far from here, but not far enough. This is a picture of a nuclear explosion, and it's just a plume on a large scale. Now let's return to our tank of fluid, heated from below, cooled from above. Here is a picture of the top of the fluid, a tiny little region on the top. This is a tiny region called the upper boundary layer, the top boundary layer. It is a cold boundary layer. It's a very skinny region of cold fluid. Coming down from this is a plume. You can see its head. You can see its neck. It is the plumes that come down in the picture that I drew of the heated cell. Here is a picture of more plumes. Time, for some reason, goes upward in this picture, and what we see is a plume starting out at the bottom of that kind of tank and moving across the bottom layer, hitting the wall. In the meantime, another plume is moving across the bottom, comes up, gets bigger and bigger, and is going to hit the wall in a frame after the ones we have. So what do we have? I'm going to show you another picture of the whole cell. This picture with a little higher heating rate and a little more complex. We're used to seeing our friend the thermometer hanging in the thing, but everything else we see here is plumes arranged in an elegant pattern, a pattern which now we may want to try to interpret. Remember the story I'm trying to tell. The story I'm trying to tell, the question I'm trying to ask, is how does a complexity arise in nature? This is a cartoon view of how complexity arises in a pot of heated water. You get different regions. You can see the regions in this picture, which I just put down. I'll show you again. The regions are the region on the bottom containing plumes, plumes going up the side wall. These are hot plumes, cold plumes coming down the other side, cold plumes moving across that way, some plumes coming loose and moving through the center of the tank. Yeah. Same picture. Hot stuff coming up, cold stuff going down, cold plumes. More stuff in the center than I drew in the picture, but basically the same story. This is the real thing. You don't have to believe this. You probably have to believe the picture that was photographic in character. Here the experimentalists are telling you what happens, and I will follow through on their view of what happens. The experimentalists are Zochi, Moses, and Lipshubei. They see a thin boundary layer. We saw that boundary layer. We know it exists. A thin boundary layer at the bottom of the tank. They see a wave starting to move across that boundary layer as waves move across layers of fluid. That wave is a lifted wave of hot fluid. That hot fluid throws up some spray, and the spray wants to rise and is formed into a plume. The plume gets larger and larger, and finally hits the sidewall and moves up along the sidewall. It moves up to the top of the sidewall, makes a splash as it hits the top wall. That splash produces a wave which moves across the top wall and produces plumes, which plumes fall down here and start the whole process all over again. This is a machine, a self-generating, self-created, self-defined machine. Complex with many moving parts, all designed for a purpose. The purpose is to move fluid across the cell, and in particular, to move hot fluid from the bottom of the cell to the top. Maybe. Well, purpose you shouldn't believe. However, the mechanisms for the formation of the structures in the cell, the structures that exist in the cell, there's no reason for you not to believe that. The people who saw it are dispassionate, reasonably, or, well, sort of, are willing to answer your questions. I'm here. Believe that they have the true answer to what's going on and have been checked by other people who believe in what they're doing also. Okay, now let's come back to my student, Bill Zemsky. Bill followed an old and good tradition by looking at biological evolution as a process by which an organism of species searched to improve itself by looking at itself and its near neighbors and picking the most viable biological features from among the group. This is fundamentally the evolutionary view of what happened. Bill then noted that there was a mathematical theorem, the so-called no free lunch theorem of Wolpert and McCready. This theorem envisioned, here's the hypothesis of the theorem, a search being constructed to a very long and unstructured list of possibilities, perhaps like a scrambled telephone book, without clues from supplied from outside. In that case, here comes the result of the theorem, no good strategy could be constructed for conducting the search. That means, more specifically, that you could not construct any strategy that was substantially better than shuffling through the list at random to pick out the best members. If that's true in a list of possibilities as rich and as complicated as that presented by our DNA, by our biological nature, if this view of the thing is right, then Dembski is absolutely correct. Mathematics has proven that evolution cannot produce anything as complex as is actually observed. A list which is unstructured, and a searcher who knows nothing about the structure of that list, if that list has anything like the number of possibilities in biology, the result cannot happen. In fact, not a single protein in your body can fold up into the form it actually takes if it had to do that by an unstructured search of the kind that Dembski envisions. Okay. I'm going to show you how complexity arises from simplicity in biology, in the physical things. You remember I said that equations which look like this, and I gave the name Navier-Stokes equation to, those equations describe the whole rich world of fluids. It produced sort of all the fluid stuff we could think of, including with just a little bit of extension to include the water, and that's how wet water evaporating. It produces hurricanes and weather maps of of very high complexity. I'm going to start another example now. That example is going to tell you how this equation can be formed for much simpler things. But this would be a good place to take a deep breath and listen to questions or listen to comments. If the community talked to each other and decided that it was going to all work together, that, as you know, as a computer scientist in part, produces a much richer computer and produces a much better possibility. However, it is only partially true that the set of chemicals floating around in our guts are communicating with one another. The E. coli, the bugs, do apparently have some social life and do communicate, but the other chemical compounds don't seem to. But your question is good. The question is, can we, by changing the rules of the game, change the outcome? Now, I rush to answer that one more because that's my point, which I'm going to come to after a while, so I won't answer it any more than that. Further questions? Okay, I'll go on. Okay. Now I'm going to do something which I'm going to construct the analog, the mathematical representation of a fluid from familiar objects. These familiar objects describe the many particles in motion in a fluid and some conservation laws. The number of particles in the fluid aren't lost, but the total momentum in the fluid is not lost. I'm going to describe something very simple that has those conservation laws and a few tiny technical requirements, which I put in small print. And the big idea is that if you do that kind of thing right, including the technical requirements, you construct a model which obeys the Navier-Stokes equation and hence has exactly the same behavior as the fluid. Okay, so I'm going to use two metaphors. One metaphor is of a square dance, a country dance. And the other metaphor is of a board game with pieces. Let me start out with the board game. Now, here's my board. For technical reasons, I make it into a triangle. The pieces have a place on the board, just like you would in a game of checkers, but each piece has an arrow associated with it, and that arrow points in a direction parallel to one of the six possible directions in this lattice. I want to conserve the total momentum and the total number of particles. Well, to do that, I have to remind you, those of you who haven't looked at the rules for adding momentum lately, how momentum is added. You take this momentum and that momentum, and you add them up by putting these vectors head to tail, and the total momentum is the vector that goes through the tail of this one to the head of that one, and is this arrow there. I don't need much from this. I'm just going to argue the two guys that point in opposite directions add up to zero, and this sort of Mercedes symbol of three guys at 60 degrees to each other, 120 degrees to each other, also add up to zero. Nothing more. So here's our board and the pieces, and now I'm going to tell you the rules for the game. But it's not a game which you play by moving one piece at a time. It's a game that you play like a country dance. In a country dance, there's a caller, and the caller cries out something like, "Promenade!" And what you know to do is move one step in the direction which you're facing. So this dancer here moves down to there in the next step. This dancer here moves down to there in the next step. This dancer here moves to there in the next step. And the caller then has another call. A square dance with one call would be terribly dull. The second call is, quite traditionally, swing your partner. But because this is a mathematical square dance, it isn't quite exactly that. It is swing your partner if your total momentum is zero. So this guy, this triplet, who have total momentum zero, swing around to this triplet, which is different. And this triplet, which has this doublet, which has double momentum zero, becomes that doublet. And these guys, which add up to non-zero momentum, don't do a thing, as this guy doesn't do a thing. Now, I'd point out to you that this is sort of what happens in a real gas particles keep moving until they bump into another particle and then they go do something else. That's good. I'm not ingenious enough to invent nature for myself. In fact, that's one of the main points of this talk. It takes an awful lot of ingenuity to invent anything that looks natural. This is just a slight extension of what nature does with its molecules in a gas. Now we see the outcome. Well, let me tell you the outcome. It is manifestly, obviously true that we never lose a dancer. The dancer, if the floor is big enough, stays on the floor. We never lose any momentum. All we do is twirl it around. This conserves the two essential things and produces something which obeys the Navier-Stokes equation. How do I know? Well, three scientists, de Humière, Shimonura, and Lalemant, got their hands on a big computer out in Los Alamos and set up. Well, this big computer has 2,000 places for dancers in this direction, 1,000 places for dancers in that direction. It had patterns, the world of patterns produced by fluid motion, as well as hurricanes and other things. For simple elementary actions to produce patterned and complex outputs, we require many events. This will arise either when there are many simple actors or whether there's enough time to have only a few actors go through many events. The example I gave from Los Alamos had a million actors and they went through a million or so steps. They had enough time to produce the complexity that we were after. We're coming to the end, pretty much the last interlude. Recall that Dembski imagines evolution as a process in which an organism or species searches the long list without a clue as to the content of the water, looking for a possible improvement. He then invokes the mathematical theory that in the search of a completely senseless list, no search method is better than just going through it at random. However, the bag of biological compounds, which were our remote forebears, were exactly a part of the nature around them. And if nature had a tendency to make things more complex, as does our heat engine, these bags can work in concert with the nature around them and themselves become more complex. Thus, to answer my daughter's question, it wasn't that the stuff around our remote forebears cooperated with them. It was that our remote forebears were a part of their universe and understood how the universe worked in some primitive way in which they could then do better in a random search. Natural things do have a tendency to produce complexity. We've even seen how that happens. A few more physical examples, one more speech and I'm done. I want to show you some pictures that introduce show our most recent work. This is how a fluid forms a net and drops off and drops. Beautiful picture that can reproduce itself again and again. This particular one is from Edgerton. There are ones from my colleagues' lab, my colleagues working now in the 21st century rather than in the middle of the 20th. This is a splash produced by a drop falling on a saucer. The saucer is dry, it produces a splash that looks like that. In the laboratory of Sid Nagel, that's no surprise, that's like Edgerton's splash picture of a half a century ago. This one is the surprise. This surprise is that if you pump the air out from around the splash, if you do this in vacuum, you get no splash. We were not expecting that. Unlike Behe, we do not believe that we can predict what we're going to see in nature. We do not believe that we know what's going to happen. We do not believe that we understand and that we can understand without hints being offered by the natural phenomenon. Let me show you an example here of a steel ball being dropped into a bed of sand. That steel ball produces a jet which shoots up in the air and goes to almost the height that you dropped it from. That's an atmospheric pressure. You reduce the pressure a little bit and you get two jets, a fat one at the bottom and a skinny one at the top. You reduce the pressure a little bit more and the fat jet begins to disappear until at low pressures it disappears entirely. My colleagues say they understand this. They haven't explained it to me yet, and so I'm not going to explain it to you. Human understanding can reach such things, but it is not so easy and requires looking and thinking and having things like x-ray pictures of what goes on under the surface of the sand, which they have and I do not. So complex things arise from simple stuff. So what do I think is happening in nature? Why do I think that you and I are here? If I don't believe Behe and Dembski, who implicitly or explicitly believe in a creator of this stuff, what can I believe?
What if the patterns rearrange themselves? What if the complex patterns form naturally? And you got something like plumes up. And what happens if the something like plumes form themselves into patterns given world enough and time? And if they form themselves into patterns and structures, and these things form into structures, and then structure after structure after structure forms level after level after level. Such piling of complexity upon complexity could work to produce the rich myth of biological systems. Here is how biology might work. But we're not done yet. The previous slide contains the words, what if? And a very early slide in this talk states my presumption about the world. It says, and I just repeat, the world is lawful, and the same basic laws hold everywhere and always. New domains of nature may require new laws, but all the different laws are consistent with one another. Behe and Dembski start from a different presupposition. They do believe in a creator. Their conclusions are not, as I see it, compelling, but they are possible. As in my view, as we understand more about complexity, Behe's example and Dembski's arguments will become less and less convincing. I applaud the work of Behe and Dembski. I gotta figure out where I stand on this. I'm gonna be asked. I applaud the work of Behe and Dembski. Good skeptics make good science. Behe and Dembski's work will drive further studies of complexity. However, many of their followers want to replace science in the school curriculum by the work of Behe and Dembski. I find Dembski's arguments quite beside the point, and Behe quite unimaginative about the possibilities of nature. I think intelligent design is too immature. It's not ready for prime time yet. It may never be so. It does not belong in the school's curriculum. I'm done. Questions?